Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. This week, I talked to John Elledge and George Eaton about the TV and election debates. Zan Rice, Jason Cowley and Shiraz Maher talk about the jihadi threat to Britain. And our old Bitcoin correspondent, Alex Hearn, talks to our new Bitcoin correspondent, Ian Steadman, about Bitcoin. The big question of the week revolves around leaders' debates. How many will we have? Will anybody be at them? Will David Cameron perhaps be replaced by a tub of lard, like on that episode of Have I Got News For You? I'm joined by George Eaton and by also John Elledge, who has strong thoughts on the subject. So I'm going to start with you, John. What are your strong thoughts?
I have very strong thoughts. Actually, I have incredibly weak thoughts. I think the whole thing is a little bit silly, isn't it? It feels slightly like one of those debates.
Democracy, George. John, even.
It feels like one of those debates that we're only having because, like, there's no sort of real meat in politics at the moment. Like, it feels to me like none of the parties are willing to engage on any of the big issues at the moment. So they're talking past each other. So the Tories are desperate to talk about the economy, and Labour are desperate to talk about the NHS. And until sort of one of them steps into the other's territory, they're just not going to touch each other. So we're having this conversation instead.
George, is that true? Are you and your brethren in the lobby merely focusing on this because you aren't doing any real work?
Well, I think the reason the debate is so prominent is because the broadcasters are obviously obsessed with it. So BBC News were leading on it yesterday. I don't think that's probably the top story in most voters' eyes. And then I think it is because, of course, last time, it's the first time that it happened. They did have a significant impact on the campaign. I think the Lib Dems did a lot better as a result. They won a million more votes than they'd won in 2005, when the expectation was that they'd be squeezed after the anti-Iraq mood faded and as you had a closer race between the Tories and Labour. And a lot of Conservatives, privately and some in public, believe the TV debates were the reason they didn't win a majority. The Conservatives are terrified about David Cameron being on a platform with Nigel Farage. George Osborne and Lindsay Crosby are of the view that it would be best if the debates didn't happen at all. Cameron, of course, has now publicly taken the stance that if they do happen, the Greens have to be there, which they see as a way of harming Labour and compensating for the damage they think Farage would do to them.
Isn't everybody, you mentioned that experience of the 2010 debates, so from what I understand, both the Labour and Tories did preparations where they had someone play Nick Clegg. I think in the case of the Tories it was Jeremy Hunt. And they, whoever was playing him, anticipated his arguments completely. You know, he sort of equidistant from eyes both of them on many things, and he said, well, you know, this is the Westminster elite. So I suppose the fear this time is that they will not just have, maybe Nick Clegg might try that again, bless him, after, you know, 5 years in government, it'd be difficult, but that the Greens and Farage would definitely be able to do that.
Yes, and it's quite interesting also that David Cameron now is suggesting that he wouldn't want to do a three-way debate with Nick Clegg and Ed Miliband, which was one of the original proposals. And I think the logic behind that is that would allow Miliband to play the outsider. Mm. So these two men have been in government together. Look at the mess they've made of the country. It's time for change. I think it's unclear at the moment whether they'll happen. Quite a lot of people think they won't happen at all. I think there's still a chance that there will be some agreement simply because Cameron made such a play of them last time. I think it would be quite hard for him to back out. But he's clearly made the calculation that the cost of not doing the debates is lower than the likely cost of doing them.
And John, you know, you're being quite down on the concept of debates. For many people, they aren't following politics in the kind of day-to-day rough and tumble that we do. If we don't have the debates, do you think there needs to be some other format, or do you just think that it's up to people to find out about the parties and their policies?
Well, there never has been before. I mean, it's very odd the way we've done this once, and now everybody is kind of leapt on it as if it's one of those.
But America's done it for a really long time. They always had presidential debates. I mean, that's why people go back to Nixon, Kennedy, as really changing that election.
There are many terrible imports from America. I don't necessarily think that's the reason to. I think the debates were interesting in 2010. If you are interested in these things, I sort of think that if we do go ahead and we've got at least four party leaders on there, possibly five, or even at some point you kind of have to start wondering, well, should the Scottish Nationalists be in there as well? I just can't quite see it being a conversation. It's going to be a lot of people kind of, sort of standing on a stage and sort of shouting abuse at each other. It would be a bit of a free-for-all. I'm just not sure.
What you're saying is you want an actual free-for-all. You just want an actual, like an arm wrestle or something like that.
I would basically like it to be, yeah, like a particularly violent mosh pit is what I'm going for here. But no, I'm just not sure how substantive a debate is going to be. Once you've got that many people in there, they're all going to be sort of squeezed right down to the sort of one-liners, to their core messages. And we kind of know what those are going to be. And they're the things we're going to be seeing in the papers and on the television, regardless of whether these debates actually happen.
So what's your prediction for what will happen, if you had to put money on it?
We're kind of getting to the point, like George should be the expert on this. I'm basically just a guy who likes the sound of his own voice in this scenario. but my feeling is I can't see Cameron doing it, because I think, as George rightly points out, it seemed at this point they think the dangers of doing it are much higher than the benefits, because, you know, we in the bubble might think it's a bit embarrassing that Cameron is refusing to do these debates, but I suspect that out there in the real world, people are not that bothered about it, even if they're aware about it.
Yeah, I suppose if Nick Clegg had refused to debate Farage, no one really would have known about it, whereas he actually went and did it and got kind of creamed by all the poll ratings show. So, George, if we take the assumption that Cameron doesn't want to do it, we'll find a way to wiggle out of it, do you think any of the broadcasters will be brave enough to empty chair him?
No, I don't. Although, interestingly, Adam Bolton of Sky has been saying he shouldn't make the assumption that they won't. I know there's an internal debate within the BBC. There are some quite senior figures who think the corporation should be prepared to empty chair him. Others who think that would be inappropriate. I actually think there will be an agreement. I think there will be a five-way one with the Greens in there, and then a head-to-head between Cameron and Miliband. And it's worth noting, I think, that Of the main parties, it's probably Labour who are the keenest for them to happen. Because although, as John says, a lot of the messages will be those we're hearing throughout the campaign, Labour see it as a rare opportunity for Miliband to speak directly, unmediated, to the country. Of course, we know he doesn't get great write-ups from the press, most of whom are Conservative supporting. And studies, I think focus groups, have shown that voters are often turned off by Miliband when they see short clips of him, but when they listen to him over a longer period of time, they start to warm to him more and he becomes more convincing. Miliband has generally held his own Prime Minister's questions since he's become opposition leader, and so Labour's big hope is that since expectations would be so low, he's the one who would benefit, and that's another fear that the Conservatives have.
Okay, well, on that note, I'll say thank you to both of you, and to promise to John that next week we'll talk about the most boring, detailed policy thing we possibly can to satisfy you.
If we can do something on bus regulation one month, that would be particularly exciting.
Do write in if you'd like to hear more about that. Thank you both.
I'm Jason Cowley, editor of The New Statesman. With me today I have Shiraz Maha, a regular New Statesman writer, an expert in radicalisation, and a senior fellow at King's College, London. And I have also with me our features editor, Zan Rice. Most recently, Zan was a foreign reporter in Africa for the Financial Times and The Guardian, and is now with us at The Statesman. We have quite an incendiary cover line this week to go with your excellent report, Shiraz, The Jihadis Among Us. And I understand that in the last week you've been talking to several British jihadis in Syria about what they're thinking about the events in Paris. So tell us a little bit about what they're saying.
The thing, what wasn't surprising was that the jihadis universally supported what happened in Paris. They endorse it, they celebrated it. But what really struck me as interesting is it seems right now that this attack is being ascribed to Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State have a huge rivalry. As institutions, they are worlds apart. And on the ground, they are killing each other in Syria. They are beheading one another. So I thought it would be interesting to sort of prod these guys and to say, well, this is an Al-Qaeda attack. How do you feel about that? And what was very interesting was to a man, every single one of them came out and said, you know, we support this. It doesn't matter who carried it out. What matters is that Charlie Hebdo was hit.
What about the murder of the Muslim policeman, the murder of the four innocent Jewish civilians at the kosher supermarket? I mean, is this all part of the same war?
It is part of the same war. Unfortunately, these guys believe in a concept called Wallah wal Bara, and what it essentially means is to love and hate for the sake of God. And so they say you have to demonstrate your personal allegiance in your day-to-day life. And so if you're a policeman, you're part of the state. Mm-hmm. They regard the state as being oppressive towards Islam and Muslims. And as a result, the policeman is fair game to them. They've not been so vocal in expressing their own thoughts about the Jews that were killed mm-hmm. in the kosher supermarket. And in a kind of perverse way, that's actually a positive thing. They don't know how to rationalize it at this moment. So a lot of the guys I talked to, I did ask them about it. No one came back to me with a solid answer. They said, well, we need to talk to our leaders. We will talk back to you.
Because the assassin, the French Malarian assassin, Koulibaly, who murdered the four Jewish people in the supermarket, he said he was acting on behalf of or directed from Islamic State.
He did. He ascribed his actions to Islamic
State.
That's
right. Whereas the French Algerian brothers, they themselves said they'd been directed by Al-Qaeda in Yemen.
Exactly. And I think it's an important thing to note here is that I don't think this is a sign of a joint attack. We sometimes sort of overthink these things. These were guys who knew each other for years and years. They were friends, and they were radical friends. And so that social bond overrides institutional allegiances. Two guys are in favor of Al-Qaeda, the other guy is in favor of Islamic State. That their personal views sort of were overridden by that overriding desire to hit Charlie Hebdo and to do this attack that we saw.
The obviously you have sources and good contacts in the security services, and the head of MI5, Andrew Parker, gave what I thought was actually quite a problematic speech last week. I mean, he delivered it after the murders and the attacks. And it was almost, I thought it could be read as a plea for more powers. And it was rather alarmist. And it gave the newspapers an opportunity to publish some extremely alarming headlines. But what is your sense about the mood inside Britain? How uneasy are the security services?
So I think there's two points to make it. I do believe Andrew Parker is right when he talks about the threat being wrapped right up, but in a way we haven't seen for a few years. We've had a 30% increase in police work related to this. Three major terrorist plots have been thwarted in the UK in the last few months relating to Syria.
Three plots. Really? Do you know of what kind?
Well, they're going to trial right now, but there are some involving guns,
right.
of the type we saw in Paris. Mm. So there's clearly a threat here. Mm. He then uses that to say we need more powers. Now, that is a debate. Look, fundamentally, there are encrypted services where you can talk to people in Syria and vice versa that security service still can't get into. They don't know how to hack into that encryption service. As a society, we need to have a discussion. At the moment, the discussion is between the security service and the government.
Yes.
As a society, we need to decide where we are comfortable with how much power we devolve to them and how much we're willing to give up. And that's the really important thing for us to look at, because we could create a totalitarian state where nothing happens. But clearly we don't want to go that way. So it is a debate for civil society to engage in and to feel...
And indeed, in publications like The Statesman and The Guardian and others will create
very
the
important
space
for this.
Will debate. Create the space for that conversation and debate. What is the sense among British jihadis? I mean, are they very keen to hit the British state? And if so, what would their targets? Who are their targets?
They have all not just people in Islamic State, but other Brits who are affiliated with other groups. Have all universally, I've seen a great change in their attitude towards Britain since the coalition bombing started.
Right.
They are very anti-British now. They regard all attacks against the UK as being fair game.
Mm.
And so we have to accept that we're in a state now where these guys do want to attack us. And realistically, without being sort of alarmist, it's almost inevitable something will happen in the UK at some stage.
And would that be a lone wolf attack? Would it be something more coordinated? I mean, what was so shocking, and the attacks in Paris were shocking at every level, but what was so shocking is how well organised it seemed. I mean, here are guys turning up with Kalashnikovs and bulletproof vests, commando style, obliterating a group of journalists at their editorial meeting. I mean, incredible.
It was, and what they've realised is Al-Qaeda's attacks, and jihadi attacks in general, have always been about a little bit of element of theatre.
Mm.
9/11 played out very well for them. It provided these very dramatic pictures. And so they've always had this element of theatre. Now, the security service has become very good at stopping people who want to build bombs, who want to put stuff together. And to construct a bomb requires a lot of work. But they're moving towards this more... sort of easygoing attitude, yeah. Essentially. Just do it, essentially. And that's very, very difficult to stop. And it doesn't need to be... Even a gun, which is, I believe in the UK, is still relatively hard to get. It doesn't need to be that. We saw with Lee Rigby, if you kill someone with ordinary, everyday tools, if the target is politically sensitive, it can create a huge impact. So they know how to capture the imagination with what they're doing.
And in the wired-up digital culture, everyone has mobile phones, people record these atrocities, and then they circulate. Zan, do you want to come in here?
Yeah, I mean, just perhaps while you're talking about that, you talk about the terrorist threat intensifying and mutating. And you make the point that the most significant strikes on Western soil in recent months in Canada, France and Australia have all involved gunmen operating alone or in small groups. Mm. Sort of over what time period has this threat mutated? And the second part of the question is, you say it's almost impossible to stop these types of attacks. Why do you think this is? And is it inevitable that we will see something like this in the UK at some stage?
So there was a very important preacher called Anwar al-Awlaki, who was with al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. If you follow these issues, you kind of know him. And al-Awlaki realized, look, all these plots are failing. If you remember, in the UK, we every summer there was a huge plot that was uncovered and dismantled. The best example of that being the liquid bomb plot.
Yes.
That was 19 people involved in a huge criminal conspiracy. I mean, it's a very, very big plot. So they decided, okay, what can we do to get around this? How can we dupe the security service, essentially? And so they said, okay, just kill people. Doesn't need to be this big, complicated thing. Just kill people. Mm. Provided you hit the right target, provided it's sensitive, it's fine. And so that played out. And, you know, I mean, Roshan Chowdhury is a great example of this. She stabbed Stephen Timms, a member of Parliament, because of the way he voted in the Commons.
Yeah, the Labour MP.
It's a remarkable thing that he was fortunate he survived that.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Can you imagine the repercussions if he had died?
Yeah.
and the political symbolism of what that would have meant. So clearly they've cottoned onto this thing. It's an everyday act. You can go to Argos, buy a knife, and you're on your way. Mm-hmm. It's not like building a bomb. So I feel it is inevitable. The number of people involved gets smaller. The attack is a lot easier planned, and that's it. They are very committed to pulling something like this off.
You, in your essay, you touch on blasphemy, and you also mention the very disturbing case of the Saudi blogger and journalist Raif Badawi, who has been put on trial, been charged, and is now has to be flogged every week,
yeah,
as well as being in prison for 10 years. Can you talk a little bit about his case and what this tells us about Saudi Arabia and its barbarism?
Badawi is a liberal blogger. He believes in human rights. He's someone we would identify with in terms of he resonates with our values. And the Saudis fundamentally believe he is a threat to the state. The Saudis actually passed a law earlier on this year which equated atheism with terrorism. So
nice.
If you are publicly atheist, it's a terrorist offence in the Saudi state. And so Badawi was picked up, sentences, very draconian measure. The State Department tried to convince the Saudis not to carry it out. But they did. And you know, they were flogging this man on the streets of Saudi Arabia. 50 lashes every Friday for them, however long it will take them to carry it out. And their foreign minister was marching in Paris last Sunday. It's
a extraordinary,
remarkable hypocrisy.
We can protest as Western journalists, but what should Western governments do when Saudi Arabia is such a strong ally of the West?
Saudi Arabia is an incredibly important ally, particularly of our country. We have huge defence contracts with them.
You've lived there, haven't you?
I grew up there. I spent 14 years in Saudi Arabia. The Al Yamama defence contract actually is... Al Yamama's a very well-known defence deal within Saudi society. So it does matter to them, but they understand the power that they can exercise over us as a result. But it is very, very difficult to know how best to deal with a state like Saudi Arabia, because clearly they are important to us, but they don't meet us in any capacity on our values in any shape or form. And I make the piece, make the point of the article, which is, how do they differ in that context from Islamic State, who we are bombing, we're at war with, we regard as a terrorist organisation, but Islamic State essentially does the same thing when it comes to blasphemy.
And one could argue, and this is complex material, maybe not for today, but Saudi has done so much to sponsor a radical form of Islam, Wahhabism, and we have had many Wahhabi preachers in our mosques in the United Kingdom, and these characters have done so much to radicalise the young British Muslim young in this country. So it's almost circular, isn't it?
It is. You know, Saudi Arabia has propagated this Wahhabist ideology around the world. It has spread this very literalist interpretation of Islam, which is dogmatic, it's confrontational, it's disengaged from modernity. And because they've got the money to do it, they are streets ahead of everyone else. And that is a big problem to undermine.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground there, as ever, Shiraz. I urge everyone to buy the magazine and read your cover story and follow all of your New Statesman commentary online. And thanks very much, Zan. I hope you'll be appearing more often on our podcast. And thanks again.
Thank you.
Statesman tech and science correspondent Ian Steadman, and I'm joined this week by former New Statesman science tech correspondent Alex Hearn. Hello, Alex.
Hello, Ian.
The old
tech
you.
For them. Yes, you are the old me. Or I'm the new you. We can look at it that way. The reason the thing that brings us together this week is Bitcoin, which I know, you know, we think about it fairly often because it's our jobs, but for people, they might not have been thinking about it for much over the last year, which is a problem because it's becoming apparent that Bitcoin is kind of falling apart, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like what everyone kind of knew in their heart over the period when Bitcoin was the new hotness is that it's something that thrives on attention. That ultimately, you know, for all whether or not you thought it was in a speculative bubble or growing to its natural end stage of each coin being worth $1 million, either way, all of that was predicated on people talking about it and its use only ever increasing and interest in it only ever increasing. And what seems to have happened over the last year is that that kind of stopped. It's not, I mean, different people will tell you different stats. And I know, for instance, Coinbase are adamant that actual real world use of Bitcoin is stable and growing. They point to the fact that over the whole of 2014, they signed up 10 billion dollar companies to the currency, which is obviously, you know, objectively good news for it. But at the same time, it doesn't counter the fact that general people, the sort of people who don't own Bitcoin, but one day in the future will have to if the currency is going to take off, they stopped caring about it a year ago.
And I have to say, I stopped caring about it about a year ago. There were lots of articles. To recap, it kind of peaked in, what was it, November 2013. It peaked at about $1,200 per Bitcoin, which was famously at the time was more than the price of gold. But then the bubble burst, and with it a lot of press attention and public attention, and that's kind of the irony here, is that it became kind of banal almost, you know. It became a mainstream thing for in a way on the internet. A lot of companies, like, you can buy websites and cars and pizzas and God knows what else. There are major sporting events like the Bitcoin Bowl that are sponsored by Bitcoin companies. But at the same, that kind of should be making it a mainstream thing, but instead just make it really boring and normal.
Right, exactly. And also, I mean, tying into that is the whole thing of everyone thought that the inevitable death of Bitcoin would be when one of these bubbles burst and it just plummeted. You know, it's had these speculative bubbles, and even Bitcoin fans will accept that there have been bubble moments in Bitcoin. Whether or not the total value of the currency is itself a bubble is an answer that remains to be seen. But certainly, you know, Bitcoin hitting 1,000 and then dropping down to 600 again, that was a speculative bubble. The thing is, what's actually happened is each of those, there's been enough true believers and enough people buying in at the bottom that the currency has been saved from those crashes. And it turns out that actually the death of Bitcoin is not with a bang but a whisper. It's been a year of steady decline, boring plateaus, but no big spikes to get attention, and also no big drops to get attention. Just really no attention at all.
It's been a very constant but gradual decline over the last 12 months, to the extent, and this week it's people started noticing again because it's dropped below $200 for the first time since for the last couple of years, I think. And at the same time, there's been a marked uptick in transaction volume, as it looks like, going on forums and Reddit and places like that, it seems like a lot of the hedge funds and other large groups who bought big in Bitcoin last year before then are now shedding it as fast as they can.
The New York Times also has a theory that there's a squeeze involved as well. That the problem you have is that if you were starting up a company specifically and frequently a Bitcoin mining company, you couldn't buy everything you needed in Bitcoin, no matter how hard you tried. So you'd need to take out your loans in dollars or in some other, you know, typically denominated currency. Now, a year on, those loans are being called in and people are having to sell their Bitcoin to pay. Bitcoin, which they had been hoarding, hoping for a tenfold increase in value to pay off their bills, they've just had to sell. And a massive glut of sales of Bitcoin from people who suddenly find that they can't pay all of their bills in cryptocurrency will always put a squeeze, which then, of course, means that even more people panic, realize that they're going to have to sell Bitcoin to pay the bills. And so you get that free fall that we've seen in the last 2 days, which is the first time it's gone from being a gentle slope downwards to something more dramatic. And so it's something that I'm hearing more and more from people who are involved in Bitcoin and people who are involved in, you know, allied areas, be that libertarianism or fringe economics, is that the blockchain is the next big thing. And the analogy is that that Bitcoin is an application of the blockchain. That if Bitcoin is something like email, a new technology, the blockchain is the internet. It's the fundamental basis of Bitcoin, and Bitcoin couldn't exist without a blockchain, but that there's more you can do with it. Blockchain is this decentralized ledger used primarily now for recording what Bitcoins are where. It's also a wonderful, not technological leap, but almost conceptual leap, the idea of using this proof of work, these complex mathematical problems where you essentially just have to burn processing power to put your stamp of credibility on what you're saying is and isn't the case. A bunch of new companies have sprung up in the last 6 or 12 months who've basically gone, well, using the blockchain just to record financial transactions is a waste. There's so much more you can do with it. So there's one London-based company called Eris Industries, which hopes to build almost a shadow internet on it, using the blockchain to do jobs that are analogous to the domain name servers and even just the simple hosts that run the internet. At the other end, there's people who want to use it to replace the stock exchange. There's people who want to use it to make legally binding contracts, that you can actually do computations with. But the problem is all of this relies still on people crunching this proof of work. If there's not people burning processing power to place their stamp of plausibility on any given transaction, the whole concept of a blockchain falls apart. And what will be interesting over the next year is if the price of Bitcoin continues to collapse and mining companies turn their rigs off as they go bankrupt, how useful is the blockchain in a world where there aren't these people doing these sums to make thousands of dollars from their Bitcoin investments and people just doing it out of the goodness of their heart to provide a backbone for an internet replacement? That doesn't seem much like how technology has worked to date.
Exactly. And there's a further irony as well in that people are sort of ganging together into what are called mining pools to they pool their shared processing power. And then they share the proceeds from mining, which kind of makes sense as a response to increasing investment costs in mining. But the problem with that is the decentralized nature of Bitcoin relies on no single person being able to control more than 50% of all the verification of what's happening transaction-wise. But if you get to a situation where the only way to make money with Bitcoin is to, you know, join a big mining pool, and that kind of undermines, like, what's the point then? It's not a decentralized currency, and that's something that's really going to be a struggle for Bitcoin as well.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I find quite interesting is that, so the machinery of Bitcoin still chugs away, and this is obviously part of their big hope, is that just because no one's paying them attention doesn't mean that improvements aren't happening. One thing that happened 2 days ago, and you can debate whether or not it's an improvement, but the Winklevi filed their SEC documents that they needed to file to be able to run their Bitcoin hedge fund, essentially. The Winklevi being Tyler and Cameron Winklevoss, the two men who, whether or not they were involved in Facebook from an early age is one of those open legal questions, but certainly who made a lot of money from their relationship with Mark Zuckerberg in the early days of Facebook. The Winklevi SEC filing, like all these things, has to lay out potential dangers for their new financial corporation. And it's kind of brilliant because it's just a massive, massive list of everything that can go wrong with Bitcoin. It's the sort of thing that you don't see people who are heavily invested in Bitcoin writing all that often, because the structure of Bitcoin doesn't require them to. The SEC, which is the American Securities and Exchange Commission, does. The documents have to be true and have to fully, candidly, and accurately lay out risk factors with respect to their proposed trust. So they've just got this long, long list of things. Like you say, 51% attacks, which is where someone controls 51% of the pool, are a real threat. So they have to write that if someone gets control of the mining pool, that could kill Bitcoin. Similarly, they write that the whole problem with block reward halving, which is something that we haven't even talked about yet, that could down the line cause its own problem. That miners get rewarded, miners get given a lump sum of Bitcoin one miner gets given a lump sum of Bitcoin every 10 minutes based on how quickly they solved the algorithms that are at the heart of Bitcoin. At the same time, those rewards halve every 4 years. They've halved once and it didn't do that much problem. But as time goes on, as electricity costs go up and the value of Bitcoin stays stable, the block rewards are going to be less and less valuable to miners. No one knows what will happen with that. Then they have to admit that they've priced their whole thing using Bitstamp, which is using a index which includes Bitstamp. Great in December when they filed the documents. Not so great now, given Bitstamp was just hacked. It's still the biggest Bitcoin provider, but it's suddenly a bit cagier if you're trying to do your multi-million dollar Bitcoin investment trust using it.
And thefts are still far too easy in Bitcoin generally.
And it's also not something which you really want to have to admit in your SEC filing, but they do. Security breaches, computer malware, and computer hacking attacks have been a prevalent concern in the Bitcoin exchange market since the launch of the Bitcoin network, they're forced to admit. I mean, their document does read like a long, long list of reasons why you really, really wouldn't want to invest in their company.
Yeah. So I guess the thing that Bitcoin advocates have to hope for now is that all those companies that have signed up to accept Bitcoin and all those people working on alternative uses of blockchain, that's enough to sustain Bitcoin from now on. Or if not Bitcoin, some other cryptocurrency that kind of takes inspiration from it.
Exactly that. I think actually the big question for Bitcoin over the next year will kind of be whether stability is a thing that it can live for. Every company that's signed up for Bitcoin right now, without exception really, is doing it on the basis of plans for the future. They're not doing it based on the money now. They're doing it based on the fact that they hope that they'll be in on the ground floor of something which is big and they're getting their infrastructure out of the way soon. If it stops growing, if it stays stagnant, the next time one of these companies gets a new payment provider or redesigns its website, are they going to keep the Bitcoin integration? And that, for me, is the big question. You know, if in 8 months' time, Dell rehauls its website and removes Bitcoin payments, that, I think, would be the beginning of the end. I mean, not just Dell. I'm not implying Dell has the power to kill it, but that, you know, things can stay stable while everyone who's adopted it keeps it. Once they start dropping it, that's the real problem.
Yes. Well, we'll wait and see. Thanks very much, Alex.
Thank you very much for talking to me.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Ian Steadman and Anna Leskovich. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Understore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. You can find us every week on iTunes or at newstatesman.com/podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.